Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Inside. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. After weeks of analysis and speculation, we're getting a picture that is still very much taking shape about how this midterm is shaping up, from statewide, congressional, as well as local races and measures. Patience, of course, is key. Election results can take days, in some cases weeks, to finalize. But some races have already been called, and there are bigger themes and messages beyond this single election. We're starting off with a statewide look. Cap Radio politics reporter Nicole Nixon had a very, very busy night bouncing around watch parties in Sacramento and joins us with what we know so far. Good morning, Nicole.
Good morning.
Or a continuation of yesterday for
you. Quick nap in the middle of the night.
Exactly. Okay, so Governor Newsom easily won re-election last night. That was predicted and expected. He was in downtown Sacramento. What was the governor's reaction?
So he gave some brief remarks last night. He showed up at an election night party for Proposition 1, which is the abortion rights ballot measure. Here's a bit of what he said last night.
And let me express my deep gratitude to the people of the state of California. I'm humbled. This is my third election in 4 years, and I'm deeply humbled by the results. Deeply humbled to have the privilege of extending my term as governor of the state of California. But I'm also deeply motivated and mindful of all the energy in this room, particularly the affirmative step the state of California took, the people of California took, in unambiguous terms to assert our values.
He's talking about, you know, the measure to add abortion rights to the state constitution. He also alluded to governors in other states, Florida, who were reelected, who have been moving to restrict abortion, restrict LGBTQ rights in those states. And he said that the results last night in California were clear that the state wants to go in the opposite direction. And he's ready to lead the state that way in his second term over the next 4 years. One thing he did not talk about last night are these state issues like homelessness, inflation, and gas prices. And that really struck me. He kept it very brief, just continuing to contrast California with these other states, Texas and Florida, where he's had these public feuds with the governors.
Yeah, and those are issues that Republicans really hit home on, including his challenger, Newsom's opponent, Republican State Senator Brian Daley, also in Sacramento last night. What did he have to say about the loss?
So Daley acknowledged this big gap between him and Newsom, but he did not concede the race. He said that he wanted to just wait and see where the ballots shake out. There are still probably millions of ballots left to be counted. So here's Daley last night.
Well, you know, obviously we love California. Both my wife and I are elected. I'm in the Senate. She's in the Assembly. You know, we have 92 years of the Daleys in California. We love California. And you know, a lot of our neighbors and friends are leaving. But we're committed to this state. We love this state. And, you know, met a lot of people along the way that are struggling in California. So we gave them an opportunity, a voice. Obviously, you know, it's a blue state and it's a tough state for a Republican. I have a great relationship with the legislators and I look forward to continuing to do what I've been doing for 26 years. We'll continue being and doing what we know is the right thing to do for California.
I mean, you heard him acknowledge that it's a blue state. Democratic voters do outnumber Republicans in California 2-1. So I don't think that was a surprise to Brian Daley last night.
Yeah. And touching upon Prop 1, you also hopped over to a watch party for Prop 1. And as you mentioned, that would include reproductive freedom, the right to abortion into the state constitution. I mean, this has been called and voters overwhelmingly voted yes. But you've also been following the state's response in preparing for the Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe versus Wade, obviously became a reality, and also the aftermath all of this year. What stands out to you about this moment?
Well, this was sort of another victory for Democrats. I mean, they did not want to be in this position where they had to put this on the ballot. None of these Democrats and reproductive rights advocates were happy in June or in May when this leaked Supreme Court draft was published showing that the Supreme Court was going to overturn Roe v. Wade. And then when that decision actually came down in June, the legislature moved very quickly to pass expanded reproductive rights in California, protecting privacy, putting more money toward reproductive services, allowing for people to come in from out of state. But abortion was a big winner nationally. This Prop 1 was expected to pass in California, but voters also are, you know, appear to be approving reproductive rights ballot measures in Vermont, Kentucky, maybe Montana. So I think this did help Democrats. You know, we were talking in the last segment 15 minutes ago about how there was this huge red wave expected to help Republicans gain control of the House, maybe the Senate. But I think that Democrats are breathing a big sigh of relief and possibly seeing abortion as a factor in them being able to stave off this big red wave that was expected.
Yeah, and even though despite in California, Democrats outnumber Republicans 2-1, there are some really key competitive congressional races that in California that could shape the balance of power in Congress. And one of those races you really just dug into is for the newly drawn District 3. You moderated debates for both the primary and the general. The candidates are Republican Kevin Kiley as well as Democrat Kermit Jones. This district is interesting. It doesn't have an overwhelming majority of either party registered. It's also just a massive district. Where do the results stand?
So this is an interesting race because you know, we're talking about results are very too early to call in a lot of races. They're coming in. Mail ballots come in. It takes some time to be counted. Kevin Kiley, I believe, is up this morning trying to find the actual results. But a former assembly or current assemblyman, he did not seek re-election, though, so whether he wins this race or not, he will not be in the assembly anymore. Republican facing a Navy veteran and physician, Dr. Kermit Jones. And yeah, looks like Kiley is ahead right
now.
Yeah,
and but it has not been called yet.
None of these, and that's the thing. That's the very crucial thing to keep in mind. Especially the closer the race is, probably the longer it will take to get, you know, to get a race call as these, like, every single ballot needs to be counted.
Yeah, you mentioned the state legislature briefly. There's a lot of interesting state legislative races in the state Senate and the assembly in our area. What are you watching? I mean, there's so many, obviously, like, so you're honing in on just a few. What stands out to you about the races at the state legislature?
A few things. There are very competitive legislative races all over the Sacramento area, and a couple factors for that. One is redistricting, so all of these boundaries have changed. In one race, the 7th Assembly District, that's a seat held by Ken Cooley, who's a longtime Democratic Assembly member. His district picked up that Folsom area, got a lot more conservative. He's in a dead heat right now. He's ahead by like 350 votes. And when there are potentially thousands of votes left to count, he's got to be feeling very nervous. So he's facing a Republican challenger, Josh Hoover, who's actually Kevin Kiley's chief of staff in the Assembly and on the Folsom School Board. Other races, there's two Democrat-on-Democrat races for the legislature that have turned out to be very expensive, very competitive. In the 8th Senate District, Angelique Ashby is about 2,500 votes ahead. Too close to call that
running
race.
Against Dave
running
Jones.
Against, yeah, former insurance commissioner Dave Jones. And then in the 10th Assembly District, which covers South Sacramento and Elk Grove, that was Sacramento Council member Eric Yetta, trailing by a pretty big margin, actually, against a Democrat Elk Grove Council member Stephanie Nguyen, who was backed by you know, law enforcement and got, along with Angelique Ashby, this late infusion of cash from outside groups, including oil companies. So both these races, very competitive, two Democrats and a lot of outside spending and very expensive.
Yeah, and open seats, you know, so that these
four open seats.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. Which is a big deal. Getting back to propositions, we obviously talked about Prop 1, but there were a lot of others from, you know, online sports gambling, banning flavored tobacco, arts in K-12 education. When you look at the current results of statewide propositions, are there any so far that have surprised you?
I think the thing that maybe surprised me the most about the props is that all of the races were called last night. We've been talking about how in California it can take a long time for results to be counted. But we rely on the Associated Press to call races, and the Associated Press called all of these propositions last night. So as far as those results go, I think everybody saw the tea leaves with polling for the sports gambling measures and expected them both to fail. I'm stunned by the margins here.
It's huge.
And
so much money devoted to both of these propositions.
Exactly. I mean, the sports betting companies poured millions, hundreds of millions of dollars into passing Prop 27, and it's just going down in flames. I think only about 17% of voters so far voting yes on that. But it'll be back, it sounds like, in 2024. These two sides, you know, the outside companies and the California tribes who want to do sports betting at their casinos in person are going to have the next, you know, year or two to craft new, come back with new and improved, and try to make that case to voters. I think that that played a huge role in this, you know, in this election, too, is that there were just ads coming from all sides and people got confused and just voted no.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's back to the drawing board. And there are some definite learning lessons from both propositions. And 2024 is not that far away. Finally, Nicole, you obviously have a very, very busy day. You're going to be taking part in a KQED and California Newsroom statewide special that's right after Insight at 10 a.m. What are you going to be talking about?
We will be talking about all of the latest, you know, continuing to bring results, analysis, and context. I think we're going to be getting into a little bit more about the control of the U.S. House, what that could mean if Kevin McCarthy does become Speaker, which is something he, you know, has been talking a lot about and hoping for. So that will be at 10 a.m., and I think we'll have that here on Cap Radio.
Thank you so much, Nicole.
Thank you.
That's Cap Radio politics reporter Nicole Nixon. Up next, we're going to have a roundtable of analysis of the midterm with Laurel Rosenhall with the LA Times, political strategist Luis Alvarado, and Paul Mitchell with the ballot tracking firm Political Data, Inc. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We are sifting through midterm election results across the state and country. From highly competitive races in California and beyond, the balance of Congress is still taking shape. But within the unknowns of these election returns are broader themes and messages of where voters stand and what issues fueled them to the polls. We're going to have a roundtable of analysis. Joining us are Laurel Rosenhall with the LA Times, political strategist Luis Alvarado, and Paul Mitchell with the ballot tracking firm Political Data, Inc. Welcome, everyone.
Thanks.
Hello. Thanks.
Hello.
When preparing for this segment, I was like, where do we begin? Oh, my gosh, like so much overstimulation the morning after a midterm. So, you know, many pivotal races obviously have yet to be called. Things are still taking shape. But I'm just curious, when you all are waking up this morning, what was the big headline or the big takeaway for you? Paul, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I mean, I think the big takeaway is, you know, we saw nationally not as big of a red wave as a lot of folks had expected. At the beginning of the night, you saw Republicans winning Florida's governor's race and Senate race, and you thought, okay, well, this is what we're in for. But with Fetterman winning, with a lot of the congressional seats, it just didn't look like this red wave, which would have been expected in a midterm election with Democrats in power and a focus on economic and inflation issues. You would have expected a red wave, but it didn't really materialize. And like we saw in 2010 in California, even as Republicans did gain a lot of seats nationally, so about probably 10, maybe 12 seats nationally, they did regain control of the House, where Kevin McCarthy will likely be the next speaker. In California, it looks like everything's going to stay pat. It I think our projection right now is that Democrats will hold the seats that they were holding going into this election cycle, and Republicans will hold theirs.
Hmm. Luis, what about you?
Well, I echo what Paul's saying. The one thing that's bright for at least Republicans in California is that many of those Republican seats stayed put as it looks so far. I think Garcia already claimed victory. And it looks like Katie Porter is still in the balance as one that was going to be flipped for Republicans. And Kevin McCarthy, so far, like Paul said, seems to be the guy who's going to be running the Congress in the next few years.
Yeah. Laurel, you have long covered California politics. What stands out to you about how the results are shaping up this morning?
I think that at the statewide level here in California, things have gone, you know, exactly as predicted, in contrast to what we saw at the national level, where there seems to be some feeling of surprise this morning that things maybe didn't go as Republican as had been expected. At the statewide level in California, it's just the results so far prove yet again that there's really no opportunity for Republicans to win statewide office in California. The margins are just overwhelming for the Democrats across the statewide offices. And in the one open race where we had the state controller's race, where there was the Republican Lonnie Chen, who had a lot of bipartisan appeal, a lot of support from independents, ran an outstanding campaign, had a very compelling message about, you know, accountability, and using the audit power. He was not at all going for kind of red meat Republican messaging whatsoever. He did great on fundraising, and, you know, and he's not close to winning at all. So I think that, you know, when it comes to statewide races in California, in that regard, no surprises, Democrats dominate.
Mm. You know, Luis, nationally, the party of the president historically doesn't fare well in midterm elections, coupled with President Biden's low approval rating. I mean, analysts really predicted it was the GOP's midterm to lose, and that may not necessarily happen, but it wasn't this red wave as Paul was talking about. So with this, that Republican lens, can you put into context the performance of GOP candidates on a national level?
I think GOP candidates did not fare well with the expectation that they had, despite of President Biden's low poll ratings, Democrats were able to connect directly with the voters in their own districts. I think Republicans who hitched their wagons to Mar-a-Lago were greatly disappointed. And also giving a perspective to 2024 with DeSantis watching the chessboard, Republicans are now basically in limbo with regards to who's going to be the head of the Republican Party moving away from this election. And Republicans truly did have an opportunity to have the red wave. And I think they just did not run an operation that actually connected with the voters. I think America is actually a little bit tired of Trumpism, and they're ready for something new. But the question is DeSantis that answer? And that now we have a much larger question mark than we had before entering.
Yeah. Paul, in California, what is voter turnout shaping up to be? Is it strong or is it weak compared to prior midterms?
Well, it's always hard to compare to prior midterms. You know, our voter file has grown so much. You know, if we look back to like a 2014, there would have been 17 million voters. If we look at 2018, there was 20 million voters. We're at over 22 million voters that will be, you know, have received a ballot or voted in this election. I would expect a 50% mark is a good kind of place to kind of look right now. We only have tabulated some of the early votes that maybe were received by county registrars up through Friday or Saturday, plus the in-person votes that were cast in some counties over the weekend and on Tuesday, in other counties just the Tuesday votes. Then we still have a lot of mail-in ballots that are coming in, ballots that were dropped off at the drop boxes and have to be signature verified. We have weeks of tabulating all of this, and so just for perspective, I think a 50% turnout is a good kind of guess right now.
Yeah, I was thinking it's like a pour over coffee. It's not drip, you know. It takes a little bit longer. You know, when it comes to Governor Newsom, handedly won re-election, votes obviously still coming in. And I know that it's hard to compare to previous election years, just given that we have more people who are registered to vote. But how does his margin fare compared to his 2018 election or even the recall? Or is it fair to compare them?
I think it's fair to compare them. You know, I think this was an extraordinary large victory for him. It's not like, you know, in elections in the past, even Jerry Brown, when he was running for governor in re-election, he had more challenging elections that he had to deal with. This election for Governor Newsom really was a bit of a gimme putt. He came out of the recall election extremely strong, not just because he had good numbers and won by a large margin, but also because some of those top tier Republicans who I think kind of the Republican consultant class would have expected to rise up and be a real general election challenger to the governor someday, they ended up literally in single digits out of the recall, and their donors were burned out. The math just didn't seem to be there. And in a way, other than that controller's race, the Republican Party has somewhat right now receded to be more of a regional party. You see the real importance for the Republicans in trying to win some of these congressional districts around the state. There are county supervisors and local government where Republicans are extremely strong. But right now, and I don't expect this to be permanent, but right now there aren't really opportunities for Republicans at the statewide level.
Yeah. Luis, his challenger, Republican State Senator Brian Dahle, I mean, obviously he lost, but he currently, percentage-wise, I mean, results are still coming in, currently garnered 42% of the returns so far. Is there a success story within this loss?
Not really. With regards to what Paul was saying is that Republicans don't hold a constitutional office anywhere in the state, and it doesn't look in the near future that we will. But the question I think is more prevalent is, you know, what do conservatives, as opposed to Republicans, what do conservatives do to ensure that they have some say with regards to governance? And in Los Angeles, we saw a Republic prior lifelong Republican turn Democrat, now as
Rick Caruso. In the mayoral race.
Yeah. Exactly.
Oh, it's like a razor thin margin. I was going to talk about that later. Yeah, but go ahead.
but that goes to what's the formula for conservatives to have a voice in governance? And many are turning in and they're changing the registration either to independents, no party preference, or straight up Democrats. And, you know, I've actually run some Democrats in this election cycle who have told me, you know what, 20 years ago, I would have been a Republican, but there's no way I can win being that carrying that label, so I have to register as a Democrat. And now what we see is an internal fight in California between extreme left Democrat versus your blue dog Democrat. And I think that is now something that's going to be seen in the future for California between candidates. And we see that in Los Angeles in real life right now.
Yeah. Laurel, when it comes to Governor Newsom, what do you think a second term will look like for the governor? I mean, leading up to the midterm, he reached out to a national audience. There were ads in Republican states taking on, you know, like governors like Ron DeSantis, for example. Do you think there's going to be a continuation of this, or do you think Newsom will turn inward and focus on the state's really most pressing issues like homelessness, housing, and cost of living?
I expect that he's going to do both. I'm sort of looking at it on two tracks. There's going to be the political Newsom that's continuing to try to lead the Democratic pushback nationally on all kinds of culture war issues and really try to come out there as this progressive warrior representing the left worldview. And then I think there's going to be the policy side and what he's going to do in Sacramento as far as governing. And in that regard, he really should focus on implementing the things that he passed in his first term, because his first term was sort of a bonanza of passing very large, in some cases, groundbreaking, sweeping new policies. But most of them are, and I'm talking about things like this new care court to compel treatment for people who are addicted to drugs or mentally ill and living on the streets. Preschool for all four-year-olds, healthcare for all low-income residents of the state, regardless of immigration status. Phasing out the sale of new gasoline-powered cars, closing ends. I mean, he has passed an enormous amount of changes, but all of those things are set to phase in the next several years. None of them have been completed so far. So he signed the law, but whether they're going to be successful laws, that's what's going to be determined in the second year, I mean, in the second term. And so on the governing side, he really needs to focus on implementing these things so that he doesn't, you know, leave in 2 years or 4 years or whenever it is and have a bunch of bills that he signed, but a bunch of sort of half-baked plans.
Yeah. Well, let's get to the next, you know, 2 to 4 years, because the governor stated in his only debate that he is committed to completing his term for governor if reelected. That would take him to 2026. Laurel, what's your confidence level the governor makes good on that with the 2024 presidential election coming up?
I think it entirely depends on factors that are outside of his control. So it will, you know, depend on who else is in the mix for the presidential race in a couple of years. You know, he's said he's not going to run. If Joe Biden is running, I'm sure he won't run. If there's Joe Biden's not running and there's kind of a questionable field and he gets a lot of pressure to run, you know, I could imagine him doing it. But I also understand he can't go into a re-election campaign saying that he's going to, you know, bail in a year or two. That obviously doesn't work. So I'm sure plan A is that he's going to, you know, stick it out as governor for 4 years. But all the signs of what he's doing externally point toward that he's preparing himself. He's preparing himself for the eventuality that maybe Democrats will want him to run. And he wants to be, you know, in position to be a contender if that's the case. That's what all the signs are pointing toward, even though that's not what he's saying.
Mm-hmm. Luis, following the recall last year, you provided some analysis. And when the governor handedly defeated the recall attempt, you said that Newsom could run for president if he wants to. You know, so I guess what are your thoughts? What's your confidence level on the governor, you know, completing his 4-year term or potentially, you know, flirting with the idea of throwing his hat into the race for the presidential election in 2024?
No, I agree with Laurel. It's what the outside Astros are going to, what the stars are need to be aligned just right. But so far, I remember watching an SNL skit over the weekend about Biden as the nominee. And truly, I don't think anybody consciously can see that he will be the nominee. The question is, what kind of mechanism is going to be enacted to find that new nominee if Biden is not it? And what's that going to look like? And the same thing applies to the Republicans. You know, we're looking at a dance with candidates, and they're going to have to try to work with donors and try to take control of their committees, and there has to be a communication strategy, and none of these things seem to be clear for any of the parties at this point. But certainly, I have no question in my mind that Gavin Newsom is going to be one of the prime characters in this story.
You know, Paul, looking at national returns, I mean, Governor Newsom received a lot of votes for re-election. Going over to the southeast, to Florida, Governor DeSantis did as well. What stands out to these both of these wins, given that, you know, they're kind of viewed nationally as these polarizing figures that would make a potentially good matchup if they debated?
Oh, yeah, it would be a great matchup if they debated. And I did hear a rumor, actually, that there was a higher education institution in the country that had offered their location up for a debate between Santis and Newsom. We'll see if something like that were ever to happen. First off, stepping back, the Rubio and DeSantis wins in Florida and how early those were called and how large they were, that is actually probably really good news for Republicans going into the 2024 presidential election. Florida does not look as purple as we might have thought in 2014. 2014 or 2016, you know. And so that really does lock down, I think, Florida as being a solidly Republican red state. When you look nationally at a lot of these races, one of the things that strikes me is that Newsom does have a message he's trying to give to Democrats around the country. And that's one of really pushing back and fighting against Republicans on core Democratic issues. It's no mistake that Gavin Newsom helped with this, you know, Prop 1 push and, you know, putting abortion rights into the state constitution. Noteworthy that that abortion measure, which would have seemed really controversial 10 years ago, actually got more votes than any other state ballot measure, got more votes than any other state constitutional office. So it
was, including the governor's race.
Including the governor's race. So it was the biggest winner on election night, something that a lot of people would have thought 10, 20 years ago was kind of like a third rail you wouldn't want to touch. Now, around the country, the abortion issue was on the ballot in five states. And the pro-choice, pro-abortion camps won all five of those ballot measures around the country. Newsom's message has been, we need to own these progressive issues. We need to fight on these issues. We need to reframe the debate. And a lot of the stuff that's been happening nationally does seem like the messaging is a little bit more on its heels, where a lot of Democrats are being told, oh, well, you really do have to, like, talk about inflation or gas prices or the economy more. And it's not that Democrats don't need to have answers on those issues. It's more of a stylistic thing. And DeSantis has a stylistic approach with his Republican messaging that is in some ways that big embrace of those core principles in the same way that Gavin does. If we did ever have a head-to-head debate there, that would be one to watch. A lot more interesting than the Dolly Newsom race.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, in a president, someone who isn't president anymore, but has a great deal of influence, obviously, is President Trump. And when it comes to Trump-backed candidates nationally, they kind of struggled more compared to Republican candidates who were not backed by Trump. I mean, I think of Georgia with the governor's race compared to the Senate race. What about former President Trump? I mean, where does this lead him? Because there is still a lot of speculation whether he will actually run in 2024.
Well, you know, a lot of this is rumor stuff, but there was a rumor that he was going to be announcing in a couple weeks. I think he has a scheduled event in 15 days or something like that, where one would presume that that's when he's going to announce that he's going to run for president. I know a lot of Democrats were hoping he would announce for president before the election to really put the midterm spotlight on Trump and his potential return to, you know, the political center stage, rather than having the spotlight be on Biden. His, like you mentioned, you know, he didn't do as well. Oz Fetterman, you know, he was backing Oz, and that was a big loss for him. Around the state, there were a lot of other congressional races that are just not as well known, where the kind of Trumpier candidates didn't end up winning on Election Day. So there is potentially some soul searching to be had there, but I don't really see former President Donald Trump as a real soul searcher.
Yeah.
I think he'll probably come out of this fighting still.
Yeah. And he still has strong supporters as well. Luis, when it comes to former President Trump and his influence and his support, I mean, where do you think that stands? What conversations are happening within the Republican Party about where they go from here for 2024, even with potentially what could become House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, who is a very strong has a very strong tie to President Trump?
I agree. There are many conversations being had right now, mostly with donors and members who lead the committees, you know, the RNCs specifically, with regards to who's going to be making the decisions where the money goes. Let's be frank. Donald Trump has overtaken all the committees. He has owned the Republican Party. But I think last night is the first time that there has been a true repudiation of what MAGA stands for. I was watching some of those candidates attempting to elevate a conversation about, you know, ballots being snuck into the process again, and actually not being received as they thought it would. The excuses are no longer going to be valid for those that are MAGA-like candidates. And it's a little bit of optimist for those Republicans that are considered the sane Republicans, the reasonable Republicans, to have an opportunity to start looking at 2024 for other races where they felt that they couldn't be allowed to have any kind of oxygen. Now they have the possibility of fighting for conservative seats that Democrats have been expecting to continue to hold or to push against Republicans. So for me, it's kind of like a moment of glee, knowing that Republicans are starting to break the fever. But the question still remains, you know, the patient still has control of the money purse, and we'll see what happens with other candidates that are going to percolate, hopefully, for 2024.
Well, switching gears, we can table that because there's a good amount of discussions that we'll be having on that in the weeks and months and a couple of years to come. You know, I want to talk about voter engagement, who actually showed up. We've been having discussions on Insight about Hispanic Americans, the Latino vote nationally. I mean, there's just huge potential there for this voting bloc, including in California. Luis, I mean, let's talk about the Latino vote. I mean, does California's turnout mirror nationally? I mean, what is it looking like so far? And who are they voting for, right? Because they're not a monolith.
Well, we have never been a monolith, but I think now more than ever, we are becoming more diverse ideologically. And as Latinos see themselves more as just general population, regular voting Americans, the issues are the ones that are the common issues like the economy, crime, and even abortion have become more prevalent in the way they look at the vote. But still, you have to have the platform to be able to talk to the issues pertaining to the communities themselves and finding leadership that actually can address the issues that they have. And I think both parties have a lot still to gain with regards to how they talk to Latinos. And maybe that is why we're starting to see Latinos move from one side to the other in different election cycles, because the issues are the ones that are moving, not the party itself, but it's the message. And that gives me a little bit of happiness to see. But at the same time, we know that there are more Latinos that are eligible to vote. We are a young voting population, and it's up to the parties and the elected and the candidates to actually find ways to communicate with this community, because so far we're seeing, at least for example, I'm going to jump back to Los Angeles. We saw the Caruso campaign spend a lot of money with Latinos. And the only reason, in my view, is that he is in this fight is because he had a very precise campaign strategy and how he was going to reach out to Latinos, not as monolithic, but as individuals, like Salvadorians, Mexican Americans, seniors. There was actually an investment, and I think it's a paying off for him.
Yeah, I mean, you can go to like my side of the family, which is like Mexican and also Cuban, and yeah, you sit us at a dinner table, which probably will happen at Thanksgiving. Very different political views. Laurel, why do you think the LA mayoral race is so tight right now between Democrat Karen Bass and, as Luis was talking about, Republican turned Democrat Rick Caruso?
Well, I think we can't discount the record-breaking amount of money that Rick Caruso put into his campaign. He's a real estate developer with great, you know, personal wealth, and he, I think, outspent Karen Bass by a margin of 13-1, if I'm not mistaken, at least 10-1. So yes, that outreach that Luis is talking about is done with a lot of money, and so it's an effective strategy that's backed by a lot of money. So you can't forget about that. I think that's one factor. It's not the only one, but that's a big one that we can't discount.
Paul, ending with you, when it comes, you joined us about a week ago when we're talking about the ballot returns for early mail-in voting. What is turnout looking like? I mean, is this kind of the typical voting patterns, the typical people that are showing up, or is it evolving?
I mean, it really is evolving still. We know the votes that came in that were mailed in early and early Dropbox votes because the county registrars, as they were receiving these ballots, were logging them and letting us know who those voters were. And like we've talked about in the past, those early voters are generally older, whiter, more affluent, more from, you know, homeowners from suburban areas. And then we generally see kind of a spike near the end of those younger voters, Latinos, independent voters. We won't really know the final turnout and the composition of the electorate probably for a couple months. At that point, people won't care as much when I put out a little report that says who voted in the general election, because we'll be talking about the next presidential by then. Come maybe January, we'll really know the true composition. And it will vary around the state. You know, in Los Angeles, we did have that competitive mayor's race. And we look at who voted in this general election, some really striking numbers from this morning. 40% of the people who voted in this general election hadn't voted in the primary.
Wow. What do you think that says?
Well, it says that there were, you know, the campaigns were going out trying to get people who were expressly like non-voters in the primary, particularly Caruso's campaign. And while Laurel's right, money does matter a huge amount. The fact that they spent about, you know, 15% of their budget, roughly $15 million on field, and the focus of their field program was getting out voters who hadn't voted in the primary but were Caruso supporters, it's very likely that at the end of the day, the story, aside from just the money piece, will be about the fact that they did an extensive field program, the likes we've never seen in this state or this country, more money being spent on efforts like door knocking in language, going out and phone banking and texting people from those communities, real grassroots outreach that was obviously paid for by the Caruso campaign, but done in a way and at a scale that we hadn't seen before. And it could be the thing that allows this race to kind of defy the polling, too, because they were getting out a lot of voters that weren't expected. I don't think any polls were saying, here's our likely voter universe. It includes 40% of people that didn't vote in the primary.
Yeah. Well, Paul,
I would imagine.
Oh, yeah, go ahead, Luis.
I would imagine that's what helped Garcia maintain his seat in Valladares. Republicans who were defending their seats against well-funded Democrats as well, getting conservatives, Democrats to come out and also looking at those other candidates as an option for them.
Hmm. Well, Luis, Paul, and Laurel, thank you so much. We just tipped the iceberg. You know, there's still so much to talk about, but I appreciate y'all making the time.
Have a great day.
My pleasure.
And that is Laurel Rosenhall with the LA Times, political strategist Luis Alvarado, and Paul Mitchell with the ballot tracking firm Political Data, Inc. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, the CAP Radio news and digital teams have been on high alert over the last 13 hours and counting since the polls have closed, gathering and carefully organizing and analyzing the results of the midterm election. So we're going to bring in Kristen Lamb, CAP Radio Sacramento government reporter, and Chris Hagen, CAP Radio's managing editor of digital content. Hey, y'all.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Kristen, I want to start with you. There's a lot of really important local races in Sacramento that you're watching, many that have not been called. I mean, this is going to take days and in some cases, maybe even a couple weeks or so. So what are you watching? What stands out to you this morning?
Yeah, so for Measure A, the Sacramento County transportation tax is trailing in the early results. Meanwhile, the city of Sacramento, Measures L and O, have more yes than no votes so far. Measure O would ban encampments on public property once certain conditions are met, and Measure L would create a youth services fund for the city of Sacramento.
The face of the Sacramento City Council has a really significant potential to change, you know, having more women than ever, people of color, you know, and these races have yet to be called as well. But what's the latest on these races? There's three that you're currently watching.
Two of the city council races are pretty close in the early results. In District 3, Karina Talamantes is leading. That's in the South Natomas area. In District 5, in Oak Park, Katie Maple has more votes so far. And I'll be looking for result updates in the days and weeks to come. But the District 1 seat in North Natomas could be decided sooner. Lisa Kaplan is in the lead right now.
Yeah, Chris, you and the digital team have been very busy tracking election results. And that is something that, you know, obviously listeners and people can go to throughout the day and in the days and weeks to come. What's standing out to you about this morning?
I mean, I think there's a couple of different things. I think some things that Kristen has talked about, too, that there's a lot of, you know, close local races. For me, like one of the local races that's stood out is one that isn't especially close at the moment, which is Measure L, the Sacramento Youth Funding Measure, which would, you know, require the city to spend kind of the equivalent of 40% of the cannabis business tax revenue on youth programs. As a parent in the region, this is one I heard a lot about from, you know, parents around me. And so that has 60% of the vote currently. And so that's one I'm going to keep tracking. Again, very early results, so we're going to keep watching it, but that's what I'm looking at right now.
When does your team get results? How do they come in? And, you know, and are they released in big batches or in waves? Because when we head over to the website, you have national, state, as well as local races as well.
Yeah, and so we're getting results from a couple of different places. The big one we work with is the Associated Press, which provides results to a lot of different news services, NPR included, and also is the organization that calls a lot of the races. When you hear a race called, normally that's from the Associated Press. And then for Sacramento County results, we're getting that directly from the Sacramento County Board of Elections. And really, wherever you're getting election results from, whether it's the AP or someone else, they're talking to a local election result center somewhere and putting it all together. And in California, vote by mail has really changed the way all of that works. And so Chris Nichols at Cap Radio has done a lot of really good reporting on this. And, you know, last night around 8 o'clock, we got our first wave of results, which is really those like vote by mail ballots that came in early. Around 9 or 10 o'clock, you get kind of a second wave, which is, you know, a lot of those in-person votes of people who are turning things in on election day. And then from here and through when the results are certified December 8th, counties are releasing results at different times as they get things processed in Sacramento County. That's going to be Fridays and Tuesdays mm-hmm. going forward. But, you know, every county does things their own way. And like people talk about a lot, there isn't an individual election in California or in the United States. It's a series of small elections happening all over the place. And so things kind of happen at different speeds in different places.
Yeah, given that it's easier to vote than ever, it's easier to register than ever. We have more people who are registered to vote in the state than ever before. How does that change the job that you do at Cap Radio for the digital team in terms of gathering results? Because not too long ago, we would get races, a lot more races called perhaps election night or the morning of, and that's just not the case now.
Well, it's interesting. The gathering is the same, but what we get back is very different. And so that changes the way we have to talk about it. And so that's a big thing for us, especially in how we put results on our website. We include a link to, you know, some reporting that Chris Nichols has done on when to expect results. When we put out results on social media, we definitely want to talk about, well, these are very preliminary. These have not been decided. These could change over time, and kind of setting expectations for people. So, you know, because that is very different, you know, where 20 years ago, you may know on election night, a lot of the final race calls and things like that, where that can happen in some cases now, but is not the majority and can take a very long time in some cases.
Kristen, I mean, you get out there and you actually talk to voters. What stands out to you about people who showed up to vote, the issues that really mattered to them for this midterm for Sacramento County races?
Yeah, I mean, for Sacramento County, I think Measure O is definitely one of the most contentious ones. People have very strong feelings for or against, and there's still a lot of uncertainty about how it'll actually be implemented if it passes.
Yeah, and this comes as Sacramento County's homelessness population has just, it's a record number, and it continues to grow, and that's a theme just across the state. And so I think that's why, and it's also a measure, even though it's a city measure, it's local, it's being watched across the state, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I want to thank both of you for joining us. I know you have a lot more work in the hours and days and weeks ahead. Kristen Lamb is Cap Radio's Sacramento government reporter, and Chris Hagen is Cap Radio's managing editor of digital products. Thanks for joining us.
Cool. Thank you.
Thanks.
And that is it for Insight today. Up next, we do have a KQED and California Newsroom statewide special with the latest election results from around California, plus analysis from Cap Radio's Nicole Nixon, KQED's senior politics and government editor Scott Schaefer, and KVPR's Josh Yeager. We'll be putting the state results into a national context and bringing Californians into the conversation about where we go next. Learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, you can email us, insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata, Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, and Helga Salinas. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.